When Rahm Emanuel entered the West Wing in December 2008, he felt a genuine chill. In 6 weeks, he would become Barack Obama's chief of staff amid economic collapse, frozen credit markets, a failing auto industry, and two stalled wars. The headline in The Onion wasn't far off: Black man given nation's worst job. Despite his reputation as a stiletto-tongued infighter, Emanuel was genuinely scared. That morning, an extraordinary gathering was taking place. A bipartisan fraternity of former chiefs of staff assembled to advise him. This rare moment highlighted an essential truth. The White House chief of staff role transcends partisanship, representing perhaps the most consequential non-elected position in American government. Through this powerful gatekeeper role, presidents succeed or fail based largely on who stands at their right hand. The modern White House chief of staff position emerged in 1969 when H.R. Bob Haldeman joined Nixon's administration. Nixon implemented a structured system with Haldeman as his Lord High Executioner after witnessing previous presidential disorganization. Haldeman applied corporate discipline from his advertising career with Disney. Nixon's paranoia emerged when J. Edgar Hoover falsely claimed Johnson had bugged his campaign plane. Despite their differences, Nixon and Haldeman formed an effective partnership based on efficiency. Haldeman established a system controlling presidential access, filtering information, and managing personalities. His clinical approach maintained professional distance while documenting every request on yellow legal pads to ensure follow-through. Though Watergate ended his tenure, his organizational model endured, proving effective presidents need strong gatekeepers who both shield them and deliver uncomfortable truths. James Baker's appointment as Reagan's chief of staff in 1981 demonstrated how the right gatekeeper can elevate a presidency. Despite previously dismissing Reagan as a grade B movie actor who was dangerous, Baker became vital to Reagan's success. Though an unlikely choice as a former Democrat and friend of George H.W. Bush, Reagan recognized Baker's organizational talents. Baker secured his position by proposing a troika system where Meese would oversee policy while Baker controlled presidential access, effectively securing the real power. He completed his influence by partnering with Deaver, who was close to Nancy Reagan and excelled at staging events showcasing Reagan's patriotic optimism. Baker's management style complemented Reagan perfectly. While Reagan focused on core beliefs, reducing government, strengthening military, and cutting taxes, Baker handled implementation. He created an early action plan with coherent focus on the economy, unlike Carter's scattered approach. During crises, including the 1981 assassination attempt, Baker's steady leadership proved invaluable. After 4 years, he arranged to swap positions with Treasury Secretary Don Reagan, leaving with a longevity record and bipartisan recognition as one of the best chiefs ever. Don Reagan's tenure illustrates how poor management can undermine even popular presidencies. Unlike Baker, who understood that the most important word in the title is staff, Reagan acted as if he were CEO and Reagan merely the retired chairman, boasting that a sparrow will not land on the White House lawn without my knowing about it. The Iran-Contra scandal proved catastrophic. Reagan approved selling missiles to Iran for American hostages, noting in his diary, "I gave a go-ahead." When the story broke, Reagan denied the accusations falsely. The scandal worsened when arms sale profits were discovered funding the Nicaraguan Contras against congressional prohibition. Reagan's downfall came when he hung up on Nancy Reagan, what James Baker called not just a firing offense, that may be a hanging offense. Nancy orchestrated Reagan's removal by bringing in Washington veterans to convince the president that Reagan was damaging his presidency. Howard Baker Jr. and Ken Duberstein ultimately rescued Reagan's presidency, helping him acknowledge his Iran-Contra mistake and salvage his legacy through historic engagement with Mikhail Gorbachev. Bill Clinton's presidency shows how chiefs must adapt to a president's style while providing structure. Despite campaign brilliance, Clinton struggled with governance. He spent considerable time selecting cabinet members, but almost none on White House staff, hastily naming childhood friend Thomas "Mac" McClarty as chief, reflecting the Clintons' preference for loyal Arkansas allies. The early Clinton White House was chaotic. Meetings sprawled for hours with staff lounging on floors amid coffee cartons. With an open-door policy and overloaded schedule, Clinton was perpetually late and inefficient. As Erskine Bowles noted, it took him more time to make worse decisions. McClarty, Mac the Nice, lacked the Washington savvy to control competing factions. By summer 1994, with the presidency faltering, cabinet members staged an intervention. Clinton appointed OMB Director Leon Panetta, who discovered McClarty had no organizational chart for the White House. Panetta established a clear chain of command and conducted a time and motion study of Clinton's schedule, color-coding activities to reveal his scattered focus. His leadership proved crucial when Republicans won the House in 1994, helping Clinton navigate a budget showdown with Gingrich that resulted in a government shutdown blamed on Republicans, a turning point for Clinton's reelection. George W. Bush's presidency demonstrates the dangers of parallel power centers. While Andy Card served as chief of staff, Cheney, who had essentially selected himself as vice president, created an unprecedented co-presidential arrangement. With national security experience Bush lacked, Cheney could get involved in anything I wanted. As Erskine Bowles noted, decisions flowed through Cheney, who functioned like an unfireable chief of staff. This arrangement proved problematic after 9/11, when Cheney advocated for extraordinary counterterrorism measures. Despite consensus on Afghanistan, Bush secretly directed Rumsfeld to develop an Iraq invasion plan outside normal channels. The administration built its case on questionable WMD intelligence. Brent Scowcroft, Bush Sr.'s national security advisor, publicly opposed the Iraq invasion, warning it would be very expensive, potentially bloody, and require large-scale, long-term military occupation, infuriating the younger Bush. Though initial military victory came swiftly, the aftermath descended into chaos. When Paul Bremer disbanded the Iraqi army without White House approval, it exposed Card's inability to manage the feuding national security team. Colin Powell, discovering this decision, called Condoleezza Rice. "Condi, do you know about this?" Her answer was no. The history of modern White House chiefs reveals a fundamental truth. Presidential success depends on effective gatekeeping and honest counsel. The most successful chiefs balance protecting their presidents while telling them hard truths. James Baker exemplifies how the right chief elevates a presidency, while Don Regan's tenure shows how quickly things unravel without proper leadership. The chief serves as javelin catcher, confidant, and battlefield commander, but above all, as Leon Panetta states, must be the son of a bitch who can speak truth to power. This role requires balancing loyalty with independence and organizational skill with political instinct. In our complex political landscape, gatekeepers may matter more than ever. Presidents who choose chiefs who can organize effectively, speak honestly, and navigate Washington create conditions for success. Those who choose poorly see promising administrations falter. Behind every great president stands a great chief of staff, the indispensable shadow power that makes presidential leadership possible.